Okay, picture this. A 20-year-old man with blonde hair and bluish-green eyes from Fort St. James in British Columbia. He stands around 6'2 and weighs about 200 pounds. In fact, his figure makes him an excellent hockey player and great overall athlete. He's fairly charming, polite, which is a reflection of the good home he comes from. He's popular and, oh yeah, he's a cold-blooded killer. Welcome to the first episode of Canadian Killers. This podcast will go over the crimes, investigation, and trial of known Canadian serial killers. But before we get started, I must mention this podcast will contain the topics of substance abuse, violence, sexual assault, and use explicit language. It is not suitable for younger audiences. November 27th, 2010, in British Columbia, about 10 minutes away from Vanderhoof. It was around 9:40 at night when a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer, Aaron Keller, saw headlights in the distance. A black pickup truck was speeding and driving erratically down Highway 27 from a remote logging road. Constable Aaron Keller said his gut told him something wasn't right, so he began following the truck and called for backup. Once backup arrived, they signaled for what they now could see was a GMC Sierra pickup truck to pull over. After running the license plate, the officers approached both sides of the vehicle, Keller taking the driver's side. As Keller carefully walked up, he noticed that the driver already had his license and registration out the window. Keller noted that this was weird. He had been working on the force for about a year and had done hundreds of traffic stops, and the majority of people had been too nervous to already have their papers in hand. In the driver's seat was Cody Legimakov. Looking at the young man, Keller noticed smeared drops of blood on his chin and cheek. Peering hard in the car, he saw an open can of alcohol. With his uneasy feeling about the situation, he was a little relieved to now have a reason to search the car. He told Legimakov that he needed to search the vehicle because of the alcohol he saw. As Legimakov stepped out, he saw blood on the driver's legs. Keller told him to sit in the back of the truck because it was cold, but he was going to need to search him first. In one pocket, he found a cell phone, and in the other, a multi-knife tool. And surprise, there was blood on the knife. Keller asked about the blood, to which Legimakov told him that he and a friend had been poaching deer. He said that they had clubbed a deer with a pipe wrench and even adding, and I quote, "I'm a redneck, that's what we do for fun." Even though Keller felt this wasn't the truth, he took Legimakov into custody under the Wildlife Act and called a conservation officer to check the poaching story. Meanwhile, in Legimakov's car, two crack pipes, drinks with two of the bottles half drunk, along with a pipe wrench with blood in its teething, and a monkey backpack with a polka dot wallet were found. Soon, Keller said he got an answer from the conservation officer over the radio. He said that the officer told him it was the worst case scenario. At 12:07 a.m., Cody Legimakov was arrested for the death of Lauren Leslie. Lauren Leslie was only 15 years old. Her body was found face down with her pants around her ankles and her body battered beyond recognition. Lauren Leslie had a genetic disorder that left her blind in one eye and only having 50% vision in the other. She had been diagnosed with depression, but she was known to be an overall happy child, who loved to go boating and tubing with her father. Her parents had split up years prior, but they co-parented happily. She was with her mother the night she disappeared, telling her she was off to go have coffee with a friend. Legimakov and Leslie met on a Canadian social networking site called Nextopia. He went under the name Country Boy One. Leslie was on the site to make friends, but Legimakov seemed to have other motivations. Despite having a girlfriend, Legimakov would often ask Leslie questions like, "What do you like sexually?" She always ignored the questions, or just avoided answering, or changed the topic. At one point, she even responded to one of his explicit questions, saying, "Are you actually 20? The night of her disappearance, the text between the two started at 6 p.m. He asked her what she was doing that night, and after a little back and forth, she gave him the directions to her school, which would be their meeting place in Vanderhoof. He told her not to tell anybody that they were meeting, and she replied, "We're just hanging out, right? Nothing sexual." Legimakov didn't answer. He just described his outfit and his car. Other messages were exchanged while she waited for him at the school. He told her he would get her drinks, and she told him to hurry up because it was cold. He bought drinks around 8:20, and 10 minutes later, Leslie was seen meeting up with a man in a pickup truck by her school's swing set. Even from Legimakov's own words, he came from a good home. He had a caring family, a loving girlfriend, good friends, and a decent job. So what would provoke such a random, violent attack? Well, first, this attack wasn't so random. At first, Legimakov denied all allegations, saying he'd only found Leslie's body. He claimed he saw four-wheeler tracks going off of the highway, so he decided to follow them. He found a cell phone, monkey backpack, and wrench, then followed drag marks to Leslie's body, and added that he didn't want to get caught up in the mix, so he lied. After further interrogation, Legimakov admitted that he met up with Leslie. He said the two drank, had consensual sex in the truck, then they decided to go for a ride, off-roading on the log road. He said that as they were driving, she began slapping herself and saying how she hated herself and demanded he stop the truck. She then got out and started hitting herself with a wrench she found on the floor and stabbing herself in the neck until she collapsed. Officers didn't buy this story either. After bringing up the inconsistencies to his story and the way that the body was found, Legimakov changed his confession. He admitted that he had done cocaine before they met up and they had sex on the logging road, and that's when she began hitting herself as she was pulling up her pants. He then added that he did hit Leslie just once or twice with the pipe wrench to put her out of her misery. Another RCMP officer heard the story and it sounded similar to another case he had been working on. Cynthia Ma was the mother of a little girl. 7 weeks before Leslie's death, her body was found in a tree line. Her pants were pulled down to her ankles and she had suffered from various stab wounds and blunt force trauma issues. Ma was born into a First Nations family. Her cousin introduced her to cocaine and she became addicted. She used sex work to help fund her life but wasn't happy with her choices. So she kept in contact with family and made efforts to attend NA and AA meetings. During the interrogation, he was asked about Ma's death but denied knowing who she was. However, Ma's DNA matched samples found on a sweater and socks in Legimakov's truck and a pickaxe found in his apartment. Sadly, she wasn't the only one. Natasha Montgomery was last seen 3 months before Cody was detained. She was also from a First Nations family and was the mother of two. She had a drug habit she proudly defeated once, but after the birth of her second child, she relapsed. Her cocaine addiction caused her to serve time, but on August 19th, she was released and told her mom she was excited to be coming home for her daughter's birthday. Her mom never heard from her after that and reported her missing a month later. Her body was never found. However, her DNA was found on the shorts Legimakov was wearing the day he was arrested. They were also found on a hoodie, bedsheet, curtain stains, and the walls and floors of his apartment. Jill Stanchenko was a mother of six who she loved dearly. She did struggle with a cocaine addiction that she tried to shake many times. A man collecting aluminum cans found her body in a gravel pit. She had died of a head injury and skull fracture, and the majority of her body was covered in bruises. It was noted that she suffered so much blood loss that they had difficulty collecting a sample for the autopsy. There was also strong evidence that she had been sexually assaulted. An unknown male profile was developed and matched to Legimakov after he was arrested. Her murder happened in 2009, which would have made Legimakov 19 at the time. This is how he got the label of one of Canada's youngest serial killers. According to Business Insider, the average serial killer is between the ages of 25 to 55. This is because people any younger don't have the neurological, organizational ability to venture on a killing spree. What makes this even more odd is the fact that, as we mentioned before, there's no evidence of a trauma-filled childhood or a diagnosed mental illness, and we may never be given a clear answer. At the trial, the judge and jury heard from 93 Crown witnesses and the defendant, Cody Legimakov. At first, Legimakov pleaded not guilty, but when asked about the crimes he was being accused of, he said he first met X at a house party his roommates had thrown. This sent the courtroom into a frenzy. Up until this point, nobody had heard the name X. And when he was asked to explain himself, he said because he knew he could serve jail time for his actions, he would refer to the three other people involved in these charges as X, Y, and Z because he knew snitches were treated with much respect in prison. Now, the stories he gave were long and rambly, so for time's sake, I'm going to do my best to summarize them. He told the jury that drug dealers showed up with Stenchenko at his apartment and he had sex with her. After that, the drug dealers told him that she needed to die because she owed them money. She was beaten to death in his apartment and the drug dealers took the body. He made a similar statement for Ma's death, saying that she arrived at the drug dealers one day and they told him she needed to die. He soon heard a cracking sound and Ma was supposedly dead. This time though, the body was moved in his truck and he drove them to LP Park where they noticed Ma wasn't really dead. So he gave them the pickaxe from his car and one of the drug dealers finished the job. And surprise, he testified a similar thing for Montgomery's death, that drug dealers had brought her into his apartment and said she needed to die. They beat her to death, and then they asked him for a saw and dismembered her body and took it away. The story sounded so ridiculous that even the judge brought forward his disbelief, saying his storytelling skills were so elementary that it sounded like he couldn't have more than one character doing something at once. At the last minute, Legimakov tried to switch his plea to second-degree murder, but his plea was denied. The jury took less than a day to deliberate and announced that he was guilty on all four counts of first-degree murder. For each murder charge, he was given a life sentence without eligibility for parole until he served 25 years of that sentence. And because of the nature of his crimes and believed motivation, he was registered as a sex offender. Now, I couldn't find any updates or records of his mental health being examined after his imprisonment, but I found many theories of what drove his psychotic behavior. Legimakov did testify to having a cocaine addiction on many accounts. According to Drug Free World, a known side effect to the usage of cocaine is bizarre, erratic, and sometimes violent behavior. Legimakov did testify to the usage of cocaine the night Leslie was killed, and it was a proven fact in court that he used sex workers to obtain the drug. Where the theory can fall flat is the fact that Legimakov was addicted, meaning he would have used it often. This would have made it hard for nobody to witness this erratic behavior. At one point, he even lived with three female friends, and they all testified that Legimakov never exhibited violent behavior. Legimakov is still currently serving his time. In 2015, he filed for appeal due to the decision against changing his venue and legal representation. But in 2016, the BC Court of Appeal endorsed the original judge's decision, Ledger McCoff is currently serving his time at Warkworth Institution, where he will most likely spend the rest of his life.
The information for this podcast was brought by pages from the book, The Country Boy Killer, The True Story of Cody Ledger McCoff, court transcripts, and news coverage of the Cody Ledger McCoff trial.